How's it going, everybody? Thanks so much for checking out our podcast this week. I hope everybody's doing good. I'm doing good. A little tired right now, but, you know, it could be worse. I'm on my train over here. We're, you know, doing some edits tonight and all that. I was on the train, and I noticed this guy who had the craziest beard. And it wasn't that it was, like, long and, you know, like, all over the place or anything, but he just looked, you know those guys who like look like they eat for their beard? Like you see those fucking stupid shows on TV, the beard war nonsense. But those guys that you know, this guy's eating some fucking like weird quinoa and fucking, you know, a diet fully of like just chickpeas and canola oil. And that's what he eats in order to maintain his beard. And I was, I wanted to punch him in the face because it was just disgusting looking. And it was weird because it was really full and it was dark, but it was unsuiting to his face because it was so pristine. It was like perfectly groomed, but it was long. I mean, it was probably like an inch and a half to 2 inches long, but it was really dark and it was just horrible. And all I could think of this guy like exercising specifically to keep this beard in shape, to make sure his body was okay, so it fueled it properly, and making sure he ate and drank well because of this beard, because he's in competitive beard competitions. This is what I think of, okay? I need some sort of help, please. Today's guest is a lady named Rupa Singh. She's actually a pretty interesting woman. She's, where do we even begin? She's a lawyer. She's a musician. She's an audio engineer. She's also involved heavily with yoga and like yoga retreats and talking in spirituality and talking to people about that kind of stuff professionally. And, you know, we met a couple years ago and I was always just really just intrigued by her in the sense that she's got this vibe. And I mentioned this on the last podcast when I was kind of, you know, previewing what we're going to be talking about. She really has this way of kind of like, you know, her place in the universe is something she seems to be pretty comfortable with. And not to say that she doesn't struggle like we all do, I mean, but she has definitely like a vibe about her that's very, very incredible. And I hope that comes off. I think it does. So I think you'll dig it. If you guys could go to bringsustogether.com, we've got a blog that I write a lot of stuff for. We have, you know, a podcast, obviously, that you're listening to. There's a Facebook page. There's a Twitter account. So please check our stuff out. Like us on the Facebook, please subscribe in iTunes. That would be huge if you could do that, guys. We have the next couple weeks are going to be some music podcasts. We have next week coming up is either going to be, I don't know, it's either going to be Kylesa or Jason Faulkner. I haven't nailed it down yet, one of the two. But I interviewed Laura from Kylesa the other night, and it was really incredible. And we had a great conversation. And then I got to see them, and those guys were sick. So, but that's either going to be next week or the week after. I'm not sure yet. I'm still trying to figure out in my brain how to do it. So hope you guys dig the podcast, and I'll see you later. Bye.
Have some sort of like spiritual role to play in this world, like,
yeah, maybe,
and then occupy that, and so it's then suited to you, like it suits you.
I appreciate that. You see, I think with myself with that kind of stuff, I mean, I don't know if it's like self-loathing or just like, I, you know, I was always the type of person who hated my birthday because I hated like the praise of me shit. I still do, like to this day, and I don't hate it because I'm getting older. I have no problem with gracefully aging at all, but I do have a problem with, oh, today you're special. It's something, I've always had an issue with that. Like, so even you saying it, I'm like, oh, that's so nice, but God damn, it's just weird.
No, you know what I mean? You know what? That's different from today you're special. Like to an overall acknowledgement of, whoa,
right,
without you, like the world would be like,
right,
a little bit less
than, you see, you're a much more positive person than I am. I am positive, but like I think internally am I like just beating the shit out of myself all the time.
Yeah.
But I think we all do that.
No, I feel you with that.
Right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Especially coming out of this past winter, I felt, just feel like sometimes in life you're at like crossroads and people. A friend of mine, she has this quote on her refrigerator by Salvador Dali. He's like, every day I wake up to the pleasure of being Salvador Dali, right?
Mm-hmm.
I lived with her for a while in this big Victorian in East Oakland.
Mm-hmm. And I'm listening. I just have to keep looking.
Oh, yeah.
Keep going.
And the whole time I lived with her, I always read that quote, and this is indicative of who I am internally, as saying, every day I wake up to the pressure of being Salvador Dali. And so, like, months or years later, I was like, yeah, well, you know that quote that you have on your fridge? It's like, every day I wake up to the pressure of being Rupa Singh, like, to the pressure of being myself. Mm-hmm. And she's like, that quote says, wake up to the pleasure of being Salvador Dali, like, by the way. Yeah. And I was like, see what I'm saying? Like, it's okay. So pressure-filled that I just... Because I just, like, I... There's so much... So any, like, sometimes there's crossroads, and I found this winter to be really crossroadish. And even this period right now.
Yeah. You know, dude, we've talked about this a little bit. Like, even myself, like, the last 2 years or so... You can say that, that's fine. It's like, these should equally be... Like, you're talking to this one, I'm talking to this one.
Okay, cool.
My last couple years were really rough, like real rough. I had this band thing where we were like touring and like making records. It was great, and then the dude who I wrote all these songs with, it like moved, so it fell apart. And I was in this relationship with this girl that I was like, "Fuck, that's it, the only one. This is it." I found the creator has created someone that is everything I've ever wanted in someone. And then when it would like so didn't work out for like the most obvious reason, it was like, "Fuck, okay." So then it took me like years, 2 years. To finally, like, lick my wounds enough. I went on my first date 2 weeks ago, after 2 years. You know what I mean?
Oh, my goodness.
Like, because I couldn't handle it. And I'm like, but now, all of a sudden, I'm in this fucking crazy upswing. Like, and it's, like, between that stuff and, like, you know, and the podcast stuff and this Faulkner thing, and not even that. I haven't got to tell you, like, this crazy new business thing we just started where we're doing historic preservations of unique and historic spaces. It's called, like, acoustic archiving. So we're going to abandoned hospitals. We just did the Morris Jummel House on 116th Street, which is literally the oldest house in New York City. It's supposed to be haunted, but that's... We do it... So we go into a space that's old or decrepit, and we... sonically preserve the tonal quality of the room with these super high-end microphones that were custom-made. There's only three in the world. We have all three of them. Whoa. And so we, you know, for instance, so we go to West Virginia. We go to this lunatic asylum, right? And, like, we sampled the sound of 40 or 50 different rooms, and then we take those samples, plug it into this plugin, and then you can perfectly replicate the tonal quality of the room.
I've heard of this... This phenomenon. Like,
yeah.
I think we studied it briefly.
You probably did.
I didn't know that
so let me just tell you before we even start, even though it's rolling. So, Mesta, you know Mesta, right? Mesta was like, hey, dude, I'm making this record. It's kind of a concept album about a woman losing her mind in an asylum, and I want to get the real sound of these rooms. Would you want to come on this trip with me? And I was like, I'm up for a good time, and I love to travel, and I like interesting experiences. Let's do this.
Yeah.
And he knows I like to take pictures and stuff, so I was taking pictures and taking video. So on the way, but we did it. It was a lot of fun. On the way back, we start talking about first. Well, dude, you know, people would buy something like this, like the Asylum plugin or the Colonial plugin, like with this Colonial thing we just did. Whatever it is, people would find there's a market for that, especially dark, weird shit.
Yeah.
With, you know, metal bands or emo bands or this or that. And then so he gets home and he starts listening to the audio and watching the video footage, and he's like, dude, this. He's like, fuck everything we've been doing. He's like, the real core of this is. Us and what we're doing. So he thought the video was pretty hilarious, and so he's like, let's just try to film a pilot. And so the whole, you know, angle of this thing is going to be like, we'll go to a place, we'll do like a little bit of a history. I'm like a history person.
Yeah.
Like the historic, what, you know, attributes of this building and why how it's fallen into disrepair or whatever. Then there'll be the scientific aspect of it, which will be us actually trying to preserve the sound of these places and our spaces. Plus, there'll be a bit of tomfuckery with us just acting like idiots. And so we ended up like talking to some people who were looking to invest in it. This happened literally in the last 5 weeks.
Wow.
And we booked... We've already done two. We're doing this place in Pittsburgh next weekend.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
What are you guys doing?
The Cary Blast Furnace. It's this old steel mill. It's a blast furnace.
Yeah.
And most of this stuff...
Fucking ginormous.
Enormous. And what we're really trying to focus on more is like what we're calling urban decay. So
sure,
like
parts of America that are just about to be like totally
right
obsolete.
On the fucking nose.
Yeah.
Of course you would know exactly what I'm talking about. So it's so I got in touch with them. Governor's Island here in the city, there's an old prison that was built in the 1700s. We just got in touch with them. The abandoned subway tunnels underneath City Hall, we just got in touch with them.
Wow.
DuPont Circle in D.C.
Yeah.
There's a hidden mall underneath there that's been closed since 1988. We just got access to. So it's all of this shit is like just like falling into place.
Dead.
All of the sudden. And then I'm out, you know, talking to Mesta on the phone one night when I had like no time to do my laundry.
and I'm talking on the phone outside of my laundromat, and this guy comes up to me and he's like, "I'm sorry, man, I couldn't help but overhear you, but I do post-production, and I know all these camera guys who work for the History Channel. What are you doing?" And I tell him about it. He's like, he starts emailing me, "I really want to be involved in this. This sounds incredible." And everybody I tell it to
is like,
"Wow, that's kind of unique." I mean, there are ghost hunters on television, all those bullshit things, and there's American Pickers and all these things, but this is a completely different angle. Mm-hmm. It's, like I said, it's historic, it's scientific, it's slight kind of funny sometimes, maybe. We don't really know yet.
Yeah.
So
no, it's going to be
it's going to be ridiculous, I'm sure. But like, so yeah, it's nuts.
That's
nuts.
So beautiful. Because the thing that we had studied, well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
For getting being on this path that has like good traction.
Thank
like
you.
That traction shit is like, that's what's like the magic. Because in New York, like look at how many ideas the city itself has spawned that no traction. And like to hit on something that does is so.
It's surreal. It's completely surreal.
But there was something that we learned about where there was like plugins where people would like go to like amazing concert halls or something.
Yeah, like Carnegie Hall.
Here you can, you know, get the sound or whatever. Mm-hmm. But
it's the exact same thing.
I would totally watch this.
I feel like people and we could travel like for you know obviously so we're starting.
It feels to like nerds and it also feels to like. Ooh, like...
Yeah. There's something creepy about it. There's something... So it's like completely surreal.
Underground
like,
shit, that's
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, dude, it's... And, like, these people are really receptive. Like, we're trying to get Eastern State Penitentiary in Philly, and there's an abandoned elementary school in Harlem that's owned by the Boys and Girls Club that I'm trying to get that is fucking amazing. And, but just, you know, like you said, you know, America, certainly in the last 150 years with the Industrial Revolution, has all these amazing structures that are falling into disrepair.
Yeah.
And they're going to be gone. It's going to happen inevitably. And why not, at least if they can't be physically preserved because that's too expensive, try to preserve at least one aspect of them. And that's really right. The angle of it, you know?
That's right. And we're such a visual culture, so I also appreciate the fact that you guys are helping people to understand, like, themselves as sonic beings.
Awesome.
We're so visual.
You're right. You're totally
like,
right.
Like, even when I studied cinema studies over at Tisch for those 2 years, do you know that I had to, like, fight to get into, like, a sound class? Like, cinema studies is almost entirely... the only sound that gets focused on is, like, the narrative of it. So, like, how the dialogue flows. But, like, the sound world of cinema films are far, like 10% of what's studied compared to the visual world.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of that is based in the way that silent films were, like, the first films. And there was all this, like, push and pull. Like, you know how there was all this push and pull around, like, Dylan starting to play electric?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, you're not folk?
Yeah,
you know,
sure,
there was like this huge thing, and
yeah,
that always like it strikes me so much when I think about that. I'm like, why don't people let other people grow?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, how could he not be folk? Dylan's not going to be folk because he picked up another type of instrument,
right?
So anyway, like the thing around silent films is like people were so resistant actually to sound,
sure,
and like all these scholars still refer to that period of silent films as being like the golden, like the pristine cinema experience minus sound. And so sound has, like, figured in less.
Yeah.
You know, continuously figured in less amongst the main scholars.
And that's true even to this day. If you think about music now, and you think about MP3s and stuff like that, and what people are listening to, it's not just a matter of convenience, because it obviously is very convenient to walk around with an iPod, but sonically, the sound of records today versus the sound of 20 to 30 years ago is drastically different and worse. Like, you can't deny the fact that we don't listen to dynamics, we don't listen to... All of it does take a like some sort of back burner thing, and why that is, it's really, really unfortunate.
Like in the book that I'm reading now, this book, Birth Matters, about, you know, just pregnancy and just like all the ways that pregnancy is like being taken out of women's hands in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, like cesarean sections represent like 65-70% of all births in this country.
I didn't know that. But why is that?
Because it's more convenient for the medical establishment. So it's quicker, it's surgical, it's a surgical procedure.
Right.
So they've made birth a surgical procedure.
As opposed to hours of labor, they just go in and...
Exactly.
Right.
And so there's all these drugs, too, that get to be a part of that. And so, of course, the pharmaceuticals are happy about that. And so there's so many ways that birth has been taken out of, you know, our hands. But one of the things that she's talking about is how in the hundreds and hundreds of births that she's participated in as a midwife... Just, like, making eye contact and, like, encouraging words. Here, again, is the importance of sound.
Mm-hmm.
Like, encouraging words to the women will literally dilate, like, will help the cervix to open.
Really?
You know?
That's interesting.
It's so beautiful. You should watch that documentary, actually, Birth Matters.
I'll
or The Business of Being Born.
I've been meaning to, because I've heard of it so many times.
Do you remember when Ricky Lake first started doing it, and people were like, oh, what's Ricky Lake doing now?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that girl, that woman gets shit on constantly. It's like, and she's kind of awesome, man. And she's always been
totally
awesome.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I mean, from, like, the John Waters stuff to this talk show, and everybody's like, talk show, ah. But then, like, she's a very bright lady, for sure.
Clearly.
Yeah.
And, of course, anyone who's bright is going to have multiple interests.
Yeah.
But definitely. She had a baby, and it was more surgical than she wanted. Uh-huh. And then that's when she got interested.
That's interesting. So, but what are your, I mean, are you saying it's purely a thing as far as saying, like, it's a time and money thing, and that's why they're doing it so much, and they're just not willing to let these things, like, matriculate
naturally?
So, yeah,
that's actually just, like, factually true. So there's no physiological reason why in America there's far more C-sections than in any other country. There's no physiological reason why we would go from 5% C-sections 30 years ago to 65 to 70% now. There's no body change.
Right.
The only change is the increased corporatization of our medical facilities.
Sure. Wow.
And so then, like, it's crazy, dude. It's something really fascinating to learn about,
actually. That's very interesting. That's amazing.
I know, dude. I'm actually so happy to learn about it, too, because most of my family's still in India. Uh-huh. So I haven't been present for births.
Right.
Like, I have people, you know, homegirls who are, like, just randomly present at their cousin's birth. And I just don't have that kind of access. And as a woman, like, I want to be present. I want to be alive in this life. And this is one of those, like, things. It's like, wow, this is so lifelike.
Sure.
This is real. This is some for real shit.
Yeah. That author, Gaskin, I've heard of her before. What, do you know? Has she written other monster shit? Because I've heard that name sure. Yeah. That's crazy, dude.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's interesting.
She's dope. I guess her and her husband set up this facility called The Farm in Tennessee, like, way back when it was just, like, them and the Amish or something.
Okay.
And so then they opened up this, like, birthing facility, and so she's witnessed, like, hundreds and hundreds of births.
So is this, how did you get into this again? Is this because you said you're doing, like, prenatal yoga?
Exactly. The person who taught it, she bounced. And then she was, like, a little diva-ish. Uh-huh. So I was like, well, train me, and then I'll take over for you. And she's like, oh, then I'm going to charge you no per class. I'm like, I'm a part business owner in this facility. I'm not going to pay to take no classes here. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you don't. But I have had that experience, too, as, like, you know, a young professional overcharging because you're just not sure how to, like, assert yourself.
Right, you don't know how to handle yourself, sure.
You know? But.
Like, so you're from California or something?
So, yeah, I grew up in San Diego. I was born in Chicago. And I was the first one out of my entire extended family to be born outside of India.
Okay.
So for example, went to my parents' citizenship ceremony and my brother's.
Wow.
You know, I remember that experience.
That's how old are you?
I was like 8.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. So having, you know, parents who were born in India and that impression on you growing up here as a citizen, how did that work in your head and, like, seeing what they had to go through and all that kind of stuff? I'm sure that has a lot to do with a lot of your development, certainly politically, and how you view other people and tolerance and all that stuff. So how did that work?
Totally. I mean, so for example, it wasn't until high school that someone talked about my parents having an accent that I realized that my parents sounded very different. I think that some of what happened around their deep, deep cultural differences was I just ignored them completely because it was just so unfathomable to me that I would have, like, literally no, like, generational guide to how to be in this country.
Sure.
/ how to be in this world because that's the world that I knew.
Yeah. Wow. So how many siblings you have?
I just had one older brother.
One older brother?
Yeah, and he was, like, wild, you know, wild, just out all the time. Even though we were in the suburbs, like, leather chaps. We're talking suburban San Diego, like a military suburb. Like, leather chaps, eyeliner. He wanted a Harley. He got another kind of bike. But he had a literal garage band. Nobody had a real garage band in the suburbs.
That's,
you know what I mean?
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they were called the Clap.
That's, what did he play?
He sang. He was a lead singer.
Okay. That's fucking hilarious. So wait, when did you move? How old did you move to California?
2 years old.
So you really, like, really?
Yeah, really young.
And so what was, I mean, like, the Southern California thing on your upbringing and, you know, outlook on things? I mean, I was just in Southern California for the first time in 21 years last week.
Yeah.
And I've always been kind of detached from it. Well, certainly Los Angeles. That's significantly different than San Diego. But, like, I was always like, I mean, the weather is fucking ridiculous. I get that. I mean, it's unbelievable. But, like, I was always like, I don't know. But you were brought up there, so it's a completely different.
It's different. But I always, so back and forth we would be in India. So I always had exposure to, like, a full-on urban environment, like a massively urban, densely populated environment, and then I would come right back to San Diego,
right.
And there would be all this space, and no buses, and no public transportation, and you would need a ride to get to the mall, and everyone had cars in high school. So, but what was also cool, Ryan, was that, you know, San Diego's close to the border, it's a military town. I lived in, a town that had a military base in it, where parts of, like, Top Gun were shot. So my first house party was on base.
That's crazy.
You know, and so we were so mixed. Uh-huh. Racially mixed, class-wise, we were mixed also.
Right.
And in this country, as I get older, I just realize how valuable that opportunity was to get to know people across all those lines.
Sure.
There was only one high school at the time, so everybody had to go to it.
Yeah.
You know, and so we weren't divided. And back then, radio stations weren't really that segregated either.
Right.
You know, hip-hop was just coming out, and it was playing on the same stations as, like, Heart.
Yeah.
You know, and nice so there was just this moment of, like, a kind of unity and just broad global exposure.
Sure.
Yeah, and I would never trade that. Like when I went to undergraduate in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, all of a sudden it was very black and white. And I was like asked to choose in numerous subtle ways, like do I identify as white or do I identify as black? Whereas when I grew up in San Diego, it was cool that I was only Indian.
Yeah.
Because there was also this other like Korean and white person, or there was this like Ethiopian person who were the only ones of their representation in our crew.
Right. Man, that's nuts. Where in India is your family from?
So on my mom's side, we're from Rajasthan, which is just underneath Punjab, so northwest India, desert region.
Okay.
Whenever you see, like, pictures of women with mad bracelets, like tribal desert people, colorful, real fuchsia, intense colors, that's Rajasthan.
Okay.
And on my dad's side, we're from UP or Uttar Pradesh, which it's, like, northeastern, and it includes parts of Delhi, but it goes and it borders Nepal. So that's like where the Buddha died. So the Buddha's resting place is there. And,
wow. Mm-hmm. Were you ever there for Holy Day?
I was never there for Holy, actually,
I wanted to go there for Holy Day so badly.
Yeah.
I heard of it, like I think a lot of modern Americans have, through Carl Pilkington and Ricky Gervais doing this show where he goes there and engages with the people. And it's like this guy who's an idiot having this amazing spiritual experience with these human beings. And it was, like, so beautiful, and I've always wanted to go ever since.
Totally, yeah. I feel like we should just throw collars on each other all the time.
I kind of like that, dude. I was talking... Do you know Aditi?
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to her, and I was like, dude, you want to go, like... We were talking about Holy Day, and obviously she's from India, and she was, like, really in it and missing it. And I was like, dude, you think we can go to, like, Jackson Heights, and maybe there'll be somebody, like, throwing some collar on people? She was like, yeah, probably not. And I was like, fuck.
No, there's huge Holy... So, I mean...
Really?
There's huge Holy celebrations here, but... They're held down by the Caribbean diaspora community. So they're called Pagua. It's called Pagua by Caribbean folks. Like Trinidadian Indians, Guyanese Indians out in Queens have like huge Pagua celebrations. And I went, not this year, but last year, but when I showed up, you know, it was interesting because on stage there was moments when they had folks from India and they'd be like, this is a real live Indian from India. And I'm like, oh shit, that's me.
You know, that's hilarious.
I know, yeah. And then in San Diego, we always celebrated just like we would have picnics and have Holi celebrations amongst the small amount of Indian families that were there then.
So when it comes to spirituality and yourself and between your upbringing and the person you've become, where does that lie? I mean, are you a believer in things or not? I mean, this is very complex, and I get that. And obviously a lot of that, the yoga thing can be a very spiritual thing. And you seem like you're a very spiritual person, but... I'm an atheist, but you're also super intellectual, so there's got to be this dichotomy. You know what I mean? There has to be some sort of internal, like, well, the logical person in me, but the spiritual person in me, but... So how the fuck does that work, Ruben?
I know, yeah. How does anything work when I, like, I'm a bridge, like, I'm not any one thing in any one given scenario ever.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like about Hinduism so much and the way that I understood it, so my parents were kind of rebels. They had an intercaste marriage that was also a love marriage. That means that nobody in their family came to their wedding. That was unheard of in the 60s in India when they were married.
No one came? So was it like eloping? Is that why no one came? I don't really...
They just were so rebellious about it. They met in graduate school and just like people, no one in their families came. But they, all their graduate student cohort came.
Okay.
You know, and it's just like my mom and these pictures of like beehives and like my dad in like skinny jeans. This is the 60s
That's
in India.
Awesome.
They look amazing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But so then their interpretation of Hinduism that they gave, that they passed down to us, was like based on the arts. It was based on singing these bhajans.
Mm-hmm.
It was based on sitting meditation. It was based on warrior arts. And, you know, pretty early on I understood two main things that I just love about Hinduism so much. One is that, yeah, it's polytheistic, so there's a god for every last element, essentially.
Right.
And at the same time, it's also monotheistic. We also recognize a oneness. Mm-hmm. It's both. And people often get Hinduism confused that way. They think, like, Islam is, you know, is mono, Hinduism is poly. It's actually not true. We allow for an all oneness, mm-hmm. like a unified oneness. The other thing I love so much about Hinduism is that the sacred and the sensual are completely intertwined. So much so that you have ancient temples that have, like, you know, that I grew up seeing with my very own eyes, like, of with depictions of beautiful sensual positions, people involved in sex.
Sure, like Kama Sutra stuff, or?
Well, yeah, but that same philosophy that underlies Kama Sutra, which, minus all the exotification of the Kama Sutra, is just being like a guide to have, you know, how do you have really good sex?
Right.
Like, minus all that shit, the Kama Sutra is just, it's just one way in which sensuality is like, is so sacred.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way that sensuality remains so sacred in our theology. Now, in practice, you know, everyone's fucked up these days. There's a lot of, like, post-colonial, just generational shit, sludge,
yeah.
that gets passed down.
Sure.
But through all that fray, and all the religious conservatism that and fanaticism that's, like, occupying our time, through all that fray, there's still these emblems of the ways in which we prayed in these buildings, you know, that have people, you know, in these amazing positions.
Mm-hmm.
And so those, I've always been very sensual. And it's nice that I can be that. Like, when I teach yoga, you know, I often tell the folks in my class, like, one thing that's nice about yoga is you get to make yourself moan. And in this way,
yeah, yeah.
you know, you get to spread your legs wide open, and if you feel good, you can just make yourself moan, and that's good.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to only do that with somebody else.
Right.
You know, and yeah. there can be all these different ways to be in your body and be so sensual. So I like that about Hinduism, too. All the schooling that I've got, all the education, all the degrees, all that. Like, how does it interact with my spirituality? I mean, sometimes I think that I'm, because I was always, like, a little Pollyanna-ish
mm-hmm.
to make my way through this world,
mm-hmm.
I think that sometimes I've tapped that, and there's a part of me that's just, like, flat cynical, like, flatline cynical. Like, it's hard, like, especially after, like, the winter season, it's just, like, hard sometimes to find any spark.
Yeah.
You know, in those moments when I'm just cynical.
Well, you know, obviously, seasons have a decent amount to do with what you're talking about. And you came from a place where there was no winter. So, but you decided to come here and knowing that. So, I mean, have there been moments when you've been like, fuck, I should just go back?
This was the first season, actually, Ryan, where I was saying to myself, why does anybody live in New York City?
Yeah.
Why do we do this?
I ask myself that more and more.
You know?
Yeah.
No, but I also feel guided. So no matter how much schooling I've ever gotten, I also feel very guided, especially in certain moments in life. So one thing I love about myself as a woman in particular is that I'm able to travel the world on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I had the opportunity to do that when I was in college, and I've just never stopped.
Where'd you go?
I went on something called Semester at Sea.
Okay.
And so we went to 10 different countries around the world on a boat.
That's awesome.
On a ship.
Where'd you end up? I mean, where did you go?
So we started in the Bahamas, we went to Venezuela, we went to Brazil, we went to Cape Town, we went to Kenya,
wow.
India, Vietnam, Hong Kong, Japan.
That's incredible. How long? Was that a whole semester?
It was a whole semester. Wow. It was 100 days around the world.
That's fucking crazy.
And then back to Seattle.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it was in that moment that I had a teacher figure be like, you know what, take this Lonely Planet book and go. You don't need to take any tours. That was in South Africa, actually. He's just like, get on a train and go. He was from Malawi. And I'll never forget that because after I did it, I never had to stop.
Yeah.
You understand? So, like, I recently took myself to Kingston, Jamaica. And I just took myself. And even when I got there, when on my way there, people didn't believe I was going to go by myself and I didn't know nobody. And when I got there, people were like, not believing that I was by myself.
Yeah.
And I felt so guided. I'm so held through that experience. When I travel in the world on my own, Ryan, in places I've never been before,
yeah.
I trust my instincts, and I feel a sense of being guided.
Yeah.
A safety in that. And so that doesn't leave.
But what is that? You know what I mean? What is that thing? Because I completely agree with you. I think that, well, I travel a whole bunch too, and I do a lot of it by myself because I like it. And not, that's not saying I wouldn't enjoy companionship and doing it, but there is something very liberating about doing that for sure. And so, but I agree with you. What is that feeling, you know, when you say you trust your instincts and you feel guided? What is that guidance? You know, what do you think it is? I know what, I don't even know what the fuck I think it is, but like, what do you think it is?
Well, I mean, there's a few, this is a good question. There's a few ways I think about it, Ryan. One way is that, you know, so we understand that there's like at least like 8 to 12 dimensions. Mm-hmm. But past the third, we have no clear idea of like what even the fourth would be.
Sure.
Like it's exponentially different in ways that we have yet to be able to perceive. And so if we're existing in these like these planes of existence, these dimensions of existence that we can barely understand. Mm-hmm. Then I feel like some of it is just like the ebb and flow of like life in all these like dimensional layers that we can't perceive. And so it's like this like energetic, I guess I see it as like an energetic narrative that I don't tap into except by virtue of the sort of like cellular feeling like, actually, no, Roops, don't go down this road, go down this road.
Right.
And then run into this person who's going to then show you around Kingston for the next 2 days.
Uh-huh.
Or something.
Okay.
So that's one way. It's just like a different dimensional existence. Like I'm relating to you right now.
Sure.
You know, say if you was a female and you were on your cycle and we were in the same room for just like a couple days.
Right.
You might cause me to have my cycle.
No, we'd probably lock in. Yeah, sure.
And so that, so there's something that, that I know people like reduce that to just like a hormonal, that's just like chemistry, but there's something also pretty magical about that and like a whole different dimensional layer.
I completely agree. I think, I mean, it's also like when, and I think I talked about this on another podcast with somebody, it's like watching fish swim when they do this, or birds fly, you know, and they do, there's some kind of communication where they just go this way or just go this way or just go this way, you know, and like that's kind of an amazing, amazing thing.
Another way that I understand it, Ryan, is like, so Nas, one of his albums was called It Was Written.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a very Muslim adage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this whole thing is written. It was written.
Right.
And I can't lie. Like, I also do feel like there's a way in which my life is already a story. It's been written.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I feel that instinctive guidance,
you're essentially just
tapping into this narrative,
okay?
Because I'm living my life as truly and as courageously as possible.
Sure.
The last thing that I'll say about it is like, you know, in Hinduism and in Buddhism, we believe that you can attain liberation from the mortal physical body into the just like the immortal energetic soul.
Okay.
And like energy is never born and never dies.
Totally.
And so we always say that the soul is like that energy that is never born, never dies, but that we're sort of trapped in this mortal shell. And that if you live your life to your dharma, like to your main purpose, courageously, truthfully, that you could liberate your soul ultimately and never have to come back and live this life again as a being in the mortal shell.
Like that.
And I always just feel like, oh, hell no, I'm never going to come back and live this life again. I'm definitely going to live as courageously, as boldly as I can.
Yeah.
So that way I can be liberated as just like an energetic being for eons.
I would really like that. That's great.
I know, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I don't even know where to go from here. I like how this is going. This is awesome. So as far as like education for you growing up, like how important was that? And not in the sense that it's important to every family to have their children be educated, or at least intelligent ones, you know what I mean? For you as an individual, I mean, how did that, because you're, that's the thing, people aren't going to know this, I mean, I'll give obviously the introduction to it, but I mean, your level of schooling and like the things you've done, it's kind of unbelievable, and it's fascinating. So was that always like a present thing? Were you always just like interested in learning and interested in pushing yourself that way? Or was there like a definitive moment where you were like, fuck, this is going to be this and I'm interested in this, and how does it kind of lock in?
Well, so I think I was always aware, this goes back to your first question too, I was always kind of aware that it was my parents' education that brought us over to the country.
Uh-huh.
And that it was like that as Indians, it was sort of like how we were here is part of the way that we were here was through education. unlike most Indian parents, my parents were not super strict around my education. I knew that I was going to go to some type of college, mm-hmm. but really and truly I did most of that on my own because they never navigated this collegiate system here.
Yeah.
And they didn't have that wherewithal to help me do that. So I did like kind of average in high school.
Okay.
And then because I was in sort of an advanced like placement classes, though, I was around people who were going to good colleges.
Sure.
So then when I got to my undergraduate institution, I was just like in Pittsburgh and I didn't have any friends, you know, yet. So I just dedicated myself to school. And I got really good grades and I got into a good law school. Mm-hmm. Since entering into the annals of elite education, so I've been now in like a couple top programs in the country, you know, that's part of that cynicism is because, you know, it's like being in Dharamsala. When I was in Dharamsala for my 30th birthday, which is where where the Dalai Lama sits in exile, when I was there, I celebrated my 30th birthday on my own, traveling there, and I saw a beggar, someone who, you know, without limbs or whatever, being laughed at by these like shopkeepers, and I'm sure they saw him every day. It was just like a slice of human cruelty to witness, though.
Sure.
This thing happening, where the Dalai Lama sits, like at one of the holiest places. Granted, it's because of exile that they're there. Mm-hmm. It's not probably as beautiful at all as where they were before the Chinese invasion, but. You know, to see these examples of human cruelty in even some of the most holiest places in the world. And I've been to, you know, pilgrimages to the Golden Temple for Sikhs. That's the main site.
Sure.
And I stayed there in a cramped room, you know, with all these single mothers and elder women who were sort of outcasted. Because no one gets denied a place to stay at the temple. But I didn't realize that traveling by myself would mean that I would have to be with, like, all these sort of outcasted women. You know, and I was just like head to toe with these on like filthy mattresses. And I'm like, well, this is a temple. Like, what's happening? And that's also how I feel about bearing witness to like elite education and elite institutions, mm-hmm. including at the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, when I was there, I wore a head wrap one day and I became this like a spectacle because I was asked to remove my head wrap. This was post 9/11 by the then Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Wait. John Roberts or who
was
at the time. Wait, please tell me that entire story if you could. I had no idea, and that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's all news, Ryan, but I'll tell it to
no,
you.
No, but I want to know, and it's interesting. So you went to the Supreme Court. What were you doing?
Well, I was doing. So I was in law school at the time at UC Berkeley, and then I had arranged to do an externship at National Public Radio. I always had a passion for media.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be at the U.S. Supreme Court, but I was like so pissed about the entire law school environment. I just wasn't getting the kind of grades I needed to do that.
Right.
So I'm a creative thinker, and so I was like, how do I get there?
Okay.
And I can get there by apprenticing with a Supreme Court reporter.
Okay.
And so I did that. I was an apprentice of Nina Totenberg, who's NPR's.
Yeah, I'm familiar. Jesus, really? I didn't know that. Okay.
And so when I apprenticed with her, you know, there was one day when I went to court and, you know, I wore a head wrap. And sometimes I wrap my head, you know, for purposes that are more cultural, and some have to do like my national cultural identity, and some have to do with like my hip hop cultural identity. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, my style is that. Mm-hmm. So that day, I was actually drawn by the court reporter that day. So this is one of those amazing, you know, coincidences. And you know, he drew Rehnquist looking at me, and so Rehnquist had, you know, was like leaned over to Sandra Day O'Connor and was like, "Who is that? Do you know who that is?" And
that's amazing.
I'm like, "Is he looking at me? Like, is any what?"
Because
It's a very tense environment, a very formal environment.
Yeah.
And so then he gets up and he has one of the security guards come over to me. And, you know, this is in the middle of two First Amendment arguments that day,
uh-huh.
one involving the Jehovah's Witnesses. And so that's very ironic also.
Yeah, sure.
So I was, you know, much younger and I wasn't sure what to do when the security guard asked me, you know, if I could take off my head wrap. And I was like, you mean... I had a shortcut,
uh-huh.
so my hair was going to be fucked up. I was like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
Like, and he said, well, it's not part of your religion, right? And I was like, and if I had had the wherewithal, I would have said, but it's part of my spiritual practice.
Right.
You know, but I didn't have that in me. So I was like, let me just go to the bathroom. So I went to the bathroom, and I cried a bit about
it. Dude.
I didn't know what to do.
Yeah, who the fuck? Dude, Rehnquist. That's insane, Ripa.
In the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So I took off the wrap, and I went back in, and I wrote a press release. And in the weeks that followed, because I was their position at NPR, which Rehnquist didn't know, he had no idea who I was.
Sure.
I was able to get like a blurb in the Washington Post the next day as sort of a gossipy item.
Okay.
And then that blurb and the press release like kind of caught fire worldwide. And so my cousins in India heard about it. Like folks all over the Caribbean were writing me.
What did you say in that? Was it just, was it about what you were seeing or about what happened?
That it's not appropriate to tell a woman of South Asian descent to take off a head wrap in any circumstance, but particularly in a post 9/11 environment, it reflects a kind of xenophobia at the highest level that we just would not want to encourage on a national basis. And this is right after many executions of people who were not even Muslim, but who were executed because they were South Asian.
Sure.
Because of hate crimes.
Definitely.
And so it had to do with, like, you know, with xenophobia and just being like, this is not appropriate, you know, for the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
No, it's certainly not. That's fucking fascinating. I understand it's old news, but, dude, that is crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I've had all these different experiences of seeing places in there. And so even at elite institutions, and to be honest, even at this institution, you know, like, there's renowned teachers.
Sure.
Who have taught me very well. And there's also some of those renowned teachers who would love to be in bed with me and who have made that very clear.
Sure, sure.
And those sorts of, like, aberrations of what could be very, like, sacred environments of learning or spirituality or law and order.
Right.
All those aberrations have all added up to me sort of just understanding more about the world than I would like to.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I feel so thankful to have the exposure that I've had.
I would say, I mean, those things make you the person that you are, and that's a good thing. Like even negative things and things like that. Like, yeah, it's a little tough to swallow sometimes, but overall, it's all a positive experience. And yeah, I mean, and you kind of have to look at it like that. You know, you really don't. I think you don't have a choice. You know,
you really don't. Yeah, because what are you gonna do? Like,
right?
Just gonna sit and moan about it and fucking
right? Exactly. No, you can. You have to pick your fucking self up and go do shit. Absolutely. So before we get more into the law stuff, because I am really curious about that. You're a huge hip hop fan, and tell me a little bit about the connection, because I have a problem connecting with not all. That sounds horrible for the way I come up, but like, I'm a musician. I play music, and I know music pretty well. I've been doing it for a long time, and I've talked. Our friend Eric, you know Eric downstairs, has tried so many times, and like, he'd be like, dude, this guy's talking this, and I'm like, dude, I don't listen to words initially. I eventually will, but I need things to be super musical. This is a personal thing, and I do want your opinion. I'm just explaining myself. So when it comes to like old school stuff for me, like Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul, that's super musical. Fuck yeah, it's amazing, but certainly it was also made 20 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I have a very difficult time with modern stuff myself, because I feel like the musicality, it's almost non-existent to a certain extent with a lot of stuff. And even lyrically, I mean, if someone's saying things that are really profound, it shows me on a piece of paper, I can completely connect with it, and I think that's fucking great. But as far as a medium for me that is a musical thing and that tonally can move me, I have an issue with it, personally.
Yeah.
But I know a big part of who you are and your identity is like hip-hop culture stuff and some of the things that you've had published. And we'll get into a little bit more specifics of that in a minute. But so how does that work with you? Where does it come from? How has it altered the trajectory of your life and existence?
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up through the 80s in Southern California. Mm-hmm. I was in Southern California when The Chronic first came out. I was in Southern California when Eazy-E was still doing his thing with NWA and BDP. I came up in that era. My brother was 8 years older than me, so you know, that was like a truly like musical era.
And those are super musical records. Those are all everything you just referenced are super musical, right?
Yeah, and so I had that privilege of growing up through the 80s and 90s, like when hip-hop was very rich and much less like a for-profit genre.
Right.
And also much less policed as a genre. And so by police, I mean like copyright protections. I mean like hip-hop, like divisions of police. I mean also like segregated like radio stations and those sorts of like monopolies around hip-hop that have shaped it into something much narrower than it originally was.
Yeah, sure.
I see that moment of the 80s and 90s as being a time of great fruition of the civil rights movement. So the civil rights movement and the laws around it, so that's like, it's like late 60s, early 70s is when we really had that sort of, that stuff just like settled in. Mm-hmm. That means that it took about, so there's like P-Funk and like different groups that were all like spacey and like, you know, just like perceiving of whole new ways of thinking about the universe, which are actually pretty similar to some like Hindu like philosophies. But we had that moment, and then there was like hip hop that came out, and it was like continuing on. It was like the pop culture fruition of the rights that people had acquired. Like, once you do have the right to be free, what do you say? What do you do? Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of what this country did was they did hip hop. Mm-hmm. You know, in all these different forms, Southern, go-go influence, or West Coast, or East Coast, mm-hmm. like the vacuousness of Staten Island, like all these different forms, but it happened spontaneously everywhere. And I just, you know, my first house parties were all hip-hop oriented. I, like, performed in a hip-hop dance crew. I was on a step team. You know, it was just a hip-hop era. And I aligned myself more so with other people of color as a way also understanding how to be in this country. Mm-hmm. So you know how it is in families. Like sometimes you're like, oh, you're my brother, but you just happen to be born into the same family as me.
Sure.
And so he, you know, I didn't really have any internal models in my family of how to be here in a way that felt right to me politically. Mm-hmm. And hip hop like kind of gave me a way to be here. And also aligning myself with people of color and rights-based struggles, human rights-based struggles around the world. Mm-hmm. That gave me a way to be here in this country.
Okay.
And that was also when hip-hop, though, was, you know, about individuality. Mm-hmm. And less and less so as time went on. But in that moment, it was still like, be crazy, be weird. Wear a big-ass condom,
right.
How the TLC was doing. Like, wear a condom
right.
on your eyeglasses.
Right. Show me.
You know, that was something that, and there was a lot of girl groups, girl hip-hop groups.
Yeah, really good ones, yeah.
Yes, and there was a lot of boy bands. There was a lot of musicality in that moment and yeah. a lot of freedom and sovereignty. As a young woman of color. Mm-hmm. And then now, it's also just like a labor of love to preserve what I understood hip-hop to be. Like, I remember being on that ship that I was talking about, mm-hmm. reading Siddhartha and listening to, like, Common Sense's Resurrection album, you know, and watching the ocean and reading Siddhartha. And the hip-hop was part and parcel of the sublimeness of that experience. Uh-huh. Like, you know, there's some people who think about hip-hop as like, oh, I'm mad cool when I blast this new Wale single. Like, I'm talking about in the here and now, when you see, like, young corporate, you know, white guys just, like, sure. blasting their hip-hop and, you know, just, like, being like, I'm super hip, or if I'm grinding on the dance floor to hip-hop, then I'm, like, so grimy, and I'm...
Right.
And it's, like, that... I understand that impulse, but for those of us who are hip-hop heads, hip-hop accompanies us in our most sacred moments of life, birth, death, mm-hmm. you know, union, divorce... It's as sublime as our lives are.
So what about now? I mean, do you still find things in it that for you currently with current things that are coming out? I mean, I'm sure you find there are things here and there, for sure. Like, I love, you know, rock music, but I don't listen to a lot of new rock music. I listen to, and I seem to be finding more and more shit that was made in the 70s and 80s when I'm like, oh my God, this is fucking ridiculous, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's or before that, or maybe the 90s, whatever. But, like, are there still things in it currently, and not just nostalgically, that you relate to and appreciate? And if there are, what the fuck are they? Because I need to... It's something I'm fascinated with. And is it purely... And if there are things, is it purely... I know this is a lot. Is it purely a lyrical thing, or is it a musical thing?
Yeah, this is a good question.
I
wish there was...
I tried real hard.
I wish there was more that I...
Me too.
That I felt guided by or strengthened by.
Sure.
But yeah, like, I pick and choose. I mean, part of what I love just overall is that this is still somehow the voice of the nation.
Sure.
A part of our nation.
Sure.
A large part
Very
of
large
our nation.
Part. Absolutely.
Whether or not we're feeling that voice for all that it's saying,
right.
you know, whether or not you're feeling that new summer jam that everyone's blasting out of their cars,
right.
that's a different issue, but it is still that. So it's just interesting to tap into almost just like as an observer. Mm-hmm. Of American culture.
Okay.
You know, and just, like, being on the same page as folks. But, like I'm thinking about, like, Flying Lotus or someone like Kendrick Lamar, where, you know, I don't agree with everything that's being said, but I so appreciate, like, the individuality that they have, like, the boldness to show I'm thinking about, like, a Nicki Minaj lyric that might, you know, like, I wish that I could be in this, like, moment for life. And, you know, just because, like, everybody dies, but not everybody lives. Like, you know, like, just because you're alive doesn't mean, just because you're alive doesn't mean you're really living. Mm-hmm. You know, and, like, certain, there's certain strains, Ryan, that, like, make it through of actual, like, actual food for thought.
I can understand that.
And whether it's, like, musical or lyrical, it's interesting because the musicality of hip-hop is embedded in his lyricism. It's, you know, it's a poet tradition. It's a poetry tradition. It's a griot tradition. Mm-hmm. So it's not separate. And even in India, like, one of the reasons why I've turned to my music with more seriousness is because I realized that our poets always sang our poems. Back in the day, the shayar, the poet, sang their poetry.
Sure.
We come from an oral tradition. And as a poet, you're, like, responsible to, like, have people really be able to memorize your shit.
Yeah.
And so I don't see the two things as separate. I know you don't really either, the lyricism and the musicality.
Okay.
Because there's a, like, in the rhythm of the tone, that's actually, that's not easy to do, like, the rhythm
sure.
of the delivery.
I can agree with that, sure.
But, like, in terms of content and musicality, like, I don't know, I just feel like, I'll say this, I wish there was more that I could really relate to.
Yeah.
And I also wish that the genre wasn't so, sometimes I wish the genre wasn't so profitable, because it's almost like now it's on this, like, auction block, and all the different parts of it have been cut off, and it's been whittled down to this one profiteering body that looks exactly like how that body should look when it's most profitable, and that's, like, siphoned off so much of the good music of it and the tradition of good music mm-hmm. that hip hop, like, comes out of
sure.
and is and lives within. And so that means that here at this school, you know, in this place,
it's okay.
but that in audio environments, it means that
right.
in sound environments.
Okay.
3, 2, 1.
You can keep. I'm a good editor. Right.
It means that in sound education environments, or in music environments, there's a lot of, like, sort of poo-pooing of hip-hop. Like, that's not real music, and I actually play an instrument, and what do you really do? Like, oh, you talk?
Right. That stuff, I agree. That's bullshit. Like, when people pull that one, I'm like, all right, fuck off. I mean, I can see there's an incredible art in sampling well, and in certainly in someone to be able to have a good flow and all that. Of course, very, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I also feel like, well, what other genre of music is so profitable and yet so unempowered to, like, control its own destiny? I feel like most hip-hop artists, you know, come in with a lack of exposure, a lack of, like financial power or social capital, like in the form of education or generational connections to wealth and power and institutions. So most hip-hop artists don't come into the industry with any of that. And so they're far more easily controlled. The interest there is to make money.
Mm-hmm.
And what gets sacrificed is, I think, a lot of musicality. You know, and I don't think that we should blame a genre for being an extension of slavery. So I do see, when I make the compare, like, the link to a rights to the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
I also think that that moment of freedom in the 80s and 90s and all that NWA stuff, it just really didn't sit well
oh, no.
with America.
It did not. But you have to think of who's in power at the time. You know what I mean? Like, you know, George H.W. Bush and a lot of those guys, these old Caucasian dudes who had no concept of what was really happening. They just had their own agenda and this whole thing and big money and, like, we're trying to steer this nation into this way, steer it back towards this thing that never actually existed to begin with. You know, that whole thing of, like, the 50s, like, Beaver Cleaver, like, yeah, golly gee shucks, go fuck yourself. It was never real. It was a myth even then, you know what I mean? And that's one of the things that bothers the fuck out of me with a lot of right-wing people who are, like, conservatives, you know, who are not just a fiscal conservative. I can understand fiscal conservatism to a certain extent, but conservatives who are, you know, are trying to turn back the clock to a time that they have just made this idealistic thing in their head about, I can never subscribe to that because it's not fucking real.
Yeah.
And it never was. When all of those things were happening in the 50s and the 40s, when people thought it was like this, oh, white bread America, here's Wonder Bread, and I've got a, you know, a Frigidaire, and look
yeah.
at this, and, like, America, okay. There were horrible things happening that people just weren't talking about, you know what I mean? And that's, like, oh, it's just made so much sense. I don't know why I went off on this little diatribe, but, you know, I think that the late 80s and early 90s was fascinating, just as you're saying, you know, and all of those things were a great representation of it. However, when challenged 20 some odd years later, I don't think personally that a lot of the music stuff reflects it nearly as well as it did then. You know what I mean? Absolutely. You look at something like NWA, and you, I mean, you're from fucking California, dude. I was in Los Angeles a month before the riots when I was a kid, but like whatever. I mean, you could feel it on the street to a certain extent. Like this, there was an energy that is not the same at all anymore. You go, I was just there like a week ago. It's fucking gone. It's gone. It was there for sure, and you felt it. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. Sure, like you're saying, you know, so the civil rights movement started at a certain time, and it has taken so much time for people to accept certain things. You know what I mean? And where am I going with this? That's a good question. Oh, but like, you know, when at a time when a nation or people need a voice and need people to help guide them, and you know, certainly after like September 11th and with the Bush administration doing some of the most disastrous shit known to man, and like, you know, what will clearly, in my opinion, go down in history as one, you know, possibly the worst leader that has ever been for America, and people don't agree with it, they can fuck off, I don't really care. The fact that a lot of artists, and not necessarily just in hip-hop, but I feel like people were speaking up, but there was something missing there, and it didn't connect with everyday people. And the same way, when you listen to fucking, you know, NWA records, you're like, fuck yeah, that's what's going on, you know what I mean? And that, yeah, there were some people who rapped about, you know, George Bush and the Twin Towers and it being a conspiracy, and that's great, good for you, that's awesome. But it was a completely different thing, when we needed it, I don't know. Do you see what I'm saying?
I absolutely do. I think in general, we have less narratives now that we need to reflect us.
Completely agree.
Like, you know, like war songs, you know,
right.
We don't have those, really. We don't have a rich narrative landscape in music that reflects all the different ways we feel as a country.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're too scared as a nation now, and also too controlled around profit and corporate profit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that there's like a reason why hip hop as a genre speaks to a pretty marginalized population base.
Sure,
still.
Sure.
And yet almost constantly is like a walking advertisement for capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Like all the shout outs around
totally.
Money
yeah.
and cars
yeah.
and even the way of treating women, that's part and parcel of capitalism and a slave system, is to just treat women as you know, money making objects,
mm-hmm.
as strippers or what have you.
Sure.
And that's all, that's crazy that this same group of people who's potentially, it's all relative, I believe everything in this life is relative, but who's potentially the most oppressed, but most violently oppressed in the country, like in terms of being in the cages or being in like neighborhoods that are consistently in states of lockdown, like my neighborhood in Flatbush,
mm-hmm.
like consistently in police states, active police presence all the time. That the same population would give rise to music that doesn't speak at all to any of that oppression or violence or state violence, but does speak to how great money is,
sure.
and how great this system is, which you are fueling by your sons and your daughters being in cages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like this co-optation of the narratives of hip hop is it's just so striking to me that it would be this genre out of all genres
yeah.
that's like required to shout out money all the time.
It's bizarre. That's a great, very well put. Like, I completely agree. And it's frustrating. I mean, like I said, I'm not a huge fan for a variety, but you know, and not because of what people are saying. It's just like I said, I need things to be a bit more musical. But I can completely, I get it. I totally get it. And like, there are elements of it I really like and respect. But like, I just, I don't know. It's disheartening sometimes.
It truly is. Yes, it is.
You know. But we talked about that for a while. But, as far as, like, so you've got all this stuff, you know, in your wheelhouse. And then, like, where as far as a passion for law, I mean, was that just, and I think I already know the answer when I ask him anyway. When you, like, first started, you know, you said you got your bachelor's and then you made a decision to go into law school. Was that a decision based on understanding, like, injustice and wanting to help people? I mean, where did it really come from? I mean, some people, I genuinely feel, Rupa, and I know, I don't know you extraordinarily well, but I know you fairly well, that it was not a financial thing. Most people I know who get into law, it's like, I want to be a lawyer, And they'll say they want to help people, but they really want to make a lot of money, because a lot of lawyers can make a lot of money. With you, I get the impression that that was really, and I can honestly say this, genuinely not the case. And that's admirable. So what was it really, and where did it come from?
It's either admirable, or it's just like a product of being lost. Like,
yeah.
There's this acronym that some Indians have for Indians in the American diaspora called American Born Confused AC.
Okay.
Or ABCD.
Okay.
And so, you know, clearly many of my cousins are just like total ABCD, like just has no idea what she's doing. And
sure.
You need to know in this life what you're doing.
Yeah.
You can't just walk around confused. But I find that, you know, I find real like wisdom in that quote that not all who wonder are lost, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I went into law school for a few reasons. One, when I was, you know, like I said, my exposure to American culture was so like actually limited. Everything I learned about the culture, I learned on my own. I didn't get anything filtered down really through my parents
right.
about America, except that their jobs were hard and, you know, that they weren't being treated great. And I got more so from them how to be Indian, you know, like let's go to Bhajans and let's go to temple and we're having Indian food every fucking day, even if we have to drive to LA to get the spices,
mm-hmm.
You know, planting gardens and cooking from our land. That stuff I got from my parents, but everything about America I got on my own. And So one of the reasons why I was interested in law is because I had like a good political science type teacher, like in social sciences.
Yeah.
You know, and I was loving the narrative around like the stories of the law. It's stories.
Yeah.
It's just stories.
You're right. I didn't think about it like that, but you're absolutely right.
All these cases are just human stories, and that I loved. I like people. I love people. I love humanity, actually.
Yeah.
And so then that gave me a wave like, all right, well, I'm not that good at math and science, or I didn't think I was. And so I'll go to law school. Like, I'm not going to go to med school. I'll go to law school.
Sure.
And I'll do something that's stable for our family. And I'll help us to be here in this country then. Because my brother was always a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I wanted to be something solid. It's also just one of the only things I knew that I could do after undergraduate. I didn't know that many options. I didn't know that people went to college to study liberal arts only.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't understand that as
sure.
a reality. So that's why I didn't, you know, I went back to school later because I was like, hey, I'm not going to be gypped out of my experience like doing a master's in arts.
Sure.
I want to do that. But then also I started doing labor organizing as a young person,
mm-hmm.
my first summer in college. So I was in something called Union Summer, organizing unions in my neighborhood back in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love facilitating. I love talking to people. And then that was also a rights-based job. And then after that, I always did community organizing in all my summers. And so then that's part of what led to feeling like, you know what, I want to help these movements as a lawyer. Yeah, I didn't quite know what else to do, also. Hmm.
I mean, because it's a pretty labor-intensive thing to be like, you know what, this is where I'm going to go. But it sounds like, you said, like, with community organizing, I think, and that's awesome that you did that, like, that stuff is hugely important. I mean, I think that people don't appreciate that stuff enough and do their part. And if everybody did do their part, just gave back a little bit and like service stuff, like that was when Obama first got elected, man, and like there was that first couple months where he was talking so much about service.
Yeah.
You know, it was like really a thing. It was in the narrative, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, am I hearing this? Like, and thinking it was fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, people can think what they want of him. I'm a fan for the most part. I mean, there are certain things that he's doing that I disagree with for sure.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a lot of the Wall Street stuff and corporate stuff that it's like, dude, really? And some rights things that it's like, nobody's perfect and it sucks, it's weird, but I don't need to get into that. But like the fact that that was part of it is just like so amazing to me.
Yeah.
And so where are you? You passed the bar here in New York, and where else?
Just here.
Just
yeah.
New York?
Yeah.
So what's the, I feel like this all, one of the reasons I want to do this with you is because I feel like you've got all of this stuff, right? Like I said, there's the hip hop stuff, there's the legal stuff, there's the yoga stuff, and it all kind of interrelates in a weird way, or at least you're making it do that, or the universe is making it do that, or probably a little bit of both is the reality of it. So what's your trajectory, dude? Like, what do you feel, like, so you've got this stuff under your belt, right? You know about audio and music, you know about law stuff, you have aspects of that that you're really passionate about. So what is your ultimate, like, where are you trying to steer the ship, or where could you see it going? I mean, it's limitless, really, as are most things, but like, what ideally would you like to try to get towards?
Ideally, Ryan?
Yeah.
Ideally, that is such a fucking good question. You know...
My mom was awesome. She just raised a girl.
I'm trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
As I go.
That's great. That's perfect.
But here's some things that I am working towards. So I'm working towards a book that offers parallels between yoga and hip-hop.
Okay.
As a way of understanding both of them as pop culture phenomenon, extremely profitable in the West.
Sure.
And then what happens when a genre becomes extremely profitable? How does it get narrowed on that same auction block?
Yeah.
Who really gets the highest price on the block? And why does it happen like that? And, you know, now we have more hip-hop studies entering, like, academia, and there's, like, a ton of hip-hop academic books now. But that wasn't the case just, like, 10, 15 years ago. And part of what's happening is a rarefied notion of hip-hop as, like, being a past thing. Mm-hmm. So, like, for a lot of people, jazz is like, oh, remember jazz? But that didn't just happen overnight. I mean, and jazz is alive and well in many ways, but not in the same way it was living.
No, it happened over about 50 years. I mean, yeah, it happened over a really long time, sure.
Whereas in some ways, we're talking about hip-hop in a past tense already.
Right. Yeah.
And that's a crazy thing to bear witness to. But also, as an Indian person in yoga, so like I'm convening and moderating a panel called South Asian Perspectives on Yoga in America in July at the Brecht Forum. I want that to be a launch of the book, although I'm not done with it by any means, and also like maybe a website or a blog for other South Asian practitioners of yoga. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at like every issue of Yoga Journal, which is a great magazine, you know, and that's the hard thing. Like everything is so gray. Mm-hmm. Like,
sure.
Like all these gray areas.
Sure.
Because I love the magazine in many ways, and yet you will never find an Indian person on the cover of that magazine. And if you had a hip-hop magazine that never had a black person on the cover of it, there would be an uproar about it. Now, of course, most of those magazines are not owned by black people.
Sure.
But we recognize that black and brown people, particularly out of New York, like, you know, gave rise to what hip-hop is now.
Absolutely.
And, like, we recognize that you have to give credence to that. You got to give credit to that. And whereas with, you know, with Indians being, like, model minorities, and that's sort of denying our... Not denying, but I feel like South Asians in general just don't have the same narrative around slavery and occupation that, you know, that the African diaspora has.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that we were not on such an extreme end of being like, well, we were never slaves. We were just indentured servants when we were cutting down sugar cane. It's like, well, what? But how do we end up all over the fucking world then? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And how is it that we were colonized in our own country for hundreds of years and we don't have an ongoing narrative about being post-colonial, you know, and not being a new democracy, but being one of the oldest nations living ancient cultures in the world, you know, which is still so ripe, even despite all the spiritual tourism and the ways that we are sort of denied our credit where credit is due. And so since I grew up with this hip-hop, you know, way, I don't feel like it's right to have yoga governing bodies in the United States be completely, you know, devoid of any Indian people and highly, highly segregated. It's a highly segregated field that came directly from India.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, like, 30 years has become so profitable that it's, like, $6 billion a year that people are spending on yoga in this country alone.
That's incredible.
And it's sequestered away from the people who... Now, say, so the same drones that Obama, you know, that his first act as presidency was not... In his presidency was not the Lilly Ledbetter Act, although that was, you know, what was most touted.
Sure.
But I think his first act was an act of war in Pakistan, you know, with the drones and all that. I think that was actually his first act. And, you know, Pakistan was only created in my parents' generation.
Uh-huh.
You understand?
Yeah.
That's India, essentially. I'm not saying that they... don't deserve to be recognized as a sovereign nation and peoples, but what I'm saying is we're brothers and sisters. We are the same peoples.
Sure.
With a political border that came out as an extension of our liberation from British occupation.
Mm-hmm.
It part and parcel. And so if Obama's bombing, you know, with Jones there, then that's happening to India too. And what I wonder is, you know, what about if Jones were to be targeted at India?
Mm-hmm.
Would this yoga community, which is now fueling its entire life off of an Indian cultural form,
right,
you know, donate any energy, any capital at all to our sustainability as a peoples?
And what do you think the answer to that is?
No, absolutely not.
I completely agree with you.
And that's whoa, that makes me, you know, just want to get a gun.
Fundamentally wrong.
But you know, I try not to speak in those ways because it's also my good fortune to be able to be a good bridge and everything, and you know, be diplomatic. And so one thing is this book, and then another is I want to share my songs, you know, and be loud as a woman. I just want to be loud and like rocking as a woman. Like I just want to just be like, I just want to be a rocker.
Okay.
And then I also want to continue to teach. I like teaching a lot. And just be sustainable. I need to make money. I got a shitload of student loans.
So. I'm sure you do. You know. So no real legal target, right? I mean, you've done it, but because it does, everything you mentioned, I mean, yeah, I could see how it could help for sure. But from what you just said in those few things, it doesn't seem like there's like a, oh, and I'd also like to be a trial lawyer for blah, blah, blah. I mean,
Seem like it, but I feel like this campaign around integration in yoga, mm-hmm. that so there's a couple legal cases that are going on now or have recently happened around yoga, mm-hmm. that I want to comment on as a legal scholar.
Oh, cool.
And I think eventually I would like to help. I'm looking like 20 or 30 years down the line, like I would like to help integrate these yoga governing bodies and even maybe create. Now, quota system is not like ideal at all, but this is just the only language I have access to right now. But some sort of like system by where we say that there has to be some South Asian presence on every yoga governing body in this country, mm-hmm. and some, you know, and some integration in every yoga magazine that's like high circulation, like some way of enforcing our rights to diversity. It's almost like another level of the civil rights movement, except now around South Asians, mm-hmm. in one of our very own cultural forms.
Man, Rupa, that that idea for a book is brilliant. That's really incredible. I don't have. There's no doubt in my mind. One of the reasons I wanted to do this too is because you are a very unique person, and in the sense that you really do, in a very genuine sense, like, walk to the beat of your own fucking drummer, which I have a tremendous amount of respect for. Like, that's an awesome, awesome thing. And, like, you, I don't know, you just have a very unique approach to a lot of things, and I think that that's awesome. And I have no doubt that you're going to do all of these things. Do you have a website or anything you want to plug?
I'm working on therupasingh.com, but okay. it's not up and running yet. But okay. That's what it'll be.
Okay. That's awesome. Thank you so much, dude. This was incredible.
Oh, thank you, Ryan.
Nice. Thanks.
That's Rupa Singh. A really cool conversation with a really cool lady. There's, you know, no doubt in my mind that there will be a time when it's like, oh, do you know who's doing this crazy thing with her life? It's Rupa Singh, and it's awesome. And I, you know, it's weird when you have friends, you like, you know, they're gonna do great things. I mean, not that she hasn't already done great things, but she's clearly got paving a road for herself that's pretty unique and just awesome. So we'll all, I'm sure, hear a little bit more from Rupa Singh at some point. Anyway, guys, please go on to bringsustogether.com, check out the blog, like us on the Facebook. If you could subscribe in iTunes, that's great. And thank you guys actually very much for rating us in iTunes. I noticed that's been happening more and more, and that's really awesome. And I've got really good reviews so far, and people saying good stuff. They're giving us all 5 stars, which I'm always really excited about. So thank you very much. More stuff coming up next week. Thanks for listening, as always, and I'll see you guys soon. Bye-bye.